Hey guys, welcome back to Making a Dietitian. I'm your host, Cassie Blanford, and today we are going to be covering upper GI disorders. This is going to be pretty brief because there are a number of disorders, and also I'm not going to be able to cover all of them. So this is just kind of like an overview of some of the ones that we typically see in case studies in like throughout the dietetics program. So I'm going to go through the pathophysiology and the MNT for these various GI disorders. So it'll be a lot of information, but I'm not going to go super in depth. If I end up needing to, if someone reaches out and says, hey, I'd like for you to cover this, totally can, not a big deal. This is just going to be kind of like the very surface. So we're going to start at the top and work our way down throughout the GI tract. Also, just bear with me because I did not write out everything, so I have all my resources in front of me. I just wanted to really get an episode out for you guys. And also, because I didn't put one out last week, we are going to have two this week. And the one later on is going to be another interview since I haven't done one of those in a while. So just be looking for that. It'll probably come out either tonight or tomorrow sometime. So yay. So obviously to start, we're going to start in the mouth or the oral cavity. This is going to include congenital defects such as cleft lip and cleft palate, and then cancers. So since we've already covered cancers, I'm really not going to go back through that. I don't think that I really need to. The biggest thing I'm going to say is just like, especially concerning mouth and esophageal cancer, you have to be really mindful of what patients can and can't eat. So you really need to discuss texture with patients and say, what can you tolerate? What can you not tolerate? Really talk about how like adding gravies is, I think my dog's about to, okay. Adding gravies is awesome. Just using like softer foods, nothing that's coarse. Don't like try and eat fried foods. That's just going to like, ugh, hurt your throat. And make sure that there are also things that people can chew easily or don't have to chew. And food temperatures. You typically, things that are either really hot or really cold are gonna not be tolerated very well. So you kind of want something in the middle, like lukewarm mashed potatoes and stuff like that. So yeah, cleft lip and palate typically develop during the second or third month of gestation, and can be due either to an inheritance or environmental factors. There's not like a one thing that causes either. So cleft lip is the failure of the maxillary processes to fuse with the nasal elevations or upper lip to fuse. It can be unilateral or bilateral, and it can occur between 4 and 8 weeks gestation. And then cleft palate is a failure of the hard and soft palates to fuse between 7 and 12 weeks gestation, creating an opening between the oral and nasal cavities. A cleft palate can create feeding difficulties, high risk of aspirating of fluids, and impaired speech development. And really the only treatment for either is going to be surgery. So moving on down, we're going to get to esophageal disorders. So this is going to include gastroesophageal reflux disease, also just what we call GERD, hiatal hernia, Barrett's esophagus, and esophageal cancer. So GERD is the result of pressure on the esophageal sphincter, leading to the gastric juices to go back up into the esophagus. Factors are lead to the pressure put on that sphincter include pregnancy, intra-abdominal pressure, distension of proximal stomach, use of muscle relaxants or NSAIDs, or scleroderma. Yeah, so signs and symptoms include heartburn, substernal pains, belching, and inflammation with ensuing erosion of the esophagus. And then in children, it's going to look more like vomiting, dysphagia, refusal to eat, and abdominal pain. So typically what we recommend whenever someone is suffering from GERD is, you know, avoid eating within 3 to 4 hours of laying down or going to bed, because you're laying down, you're literally laying down, your gravity helps keep the food in the bowel in your stomach. Don't wear tight-fitting garments because it's going to put extra pressure on your stomach. And also smoking cigarettes should be avoided as well. They do have some medical management, so like proton pump inhibitors, histamine 2 receptor antagonists, and acids. But from our end of nutritional management, we are going to focus more on decreasing exposure of esophagus to gastric contents. So you don't want to be eating large meals. You want to eat a diet that's pretty low in fat, and you really want to limit your alcohol intake. Another goal of ours is going to be decreasing acidity of gastric secretions. So you want to avoid coffee and, again, alcohol. And then you also just want to prevent pain and irritation. So any food that you feel is irritating, avoid. I think we most often say like chocolate, spicy foods, like tomato products, and then again, like those coffees. So yeah, all of those are going to have an effect, and you really just want to avoid them in general. So next we have the hiatal hernia. So this is going to be when part of the stomach is protruding through the opening, the hiatus of the diaphragm, into the thoracic cavity. So there's two types of these, sliding hiatal hernia and paraesophageal hernia, both of which don't sound very good. I'm going to be honest, we didn't really cover or like talk about this a whole lot, but it is in my resources, so I just want to really briefly cover it. So signs and symptoms of this are going to be like heartburn, sour taste in mouth after meals, belching, and dysphagia, which again, dysphagia is where you have trouble with certain textures of food with swallowing, like the inability to swallow. And really the MNT that we recommend for this is small frequent meals and avoiding a recumbent position after meals. So again, don't lay down. Barrett's esophagus is something that we talked about in class. I'm pretty sure we talked about it in MNT2. I will say it was pretty brief. I think it went along with esophageal cancer because it is a precancerous condition. I know we did a case study on it. That's really all I can tell you. So really risk factors of this, history of GERD, white males over the age of 50 are at increased risk. And then if you also have a past family history of Barrett's esophagus or endocarcinoma of esophagus. So really it's primarily squamous cell carcinoma. They didn't really talk about much about Barrett's esophagus. I guess like the MNT is going to be treating your GERD. There's not going to be, from what I can see, a whole lot to really fix, except, I mean, do what you would do for GERD, if that makes sense. And then we get into esophageal cancer, which I, again, am really not going to cover since we've already gone through cancer. So moving on to the stomach, now we're going to have peptic ulcers, gastric cancer, gastric surgeries, dumping syndrome, and gastroparesis. So peptic ulcers, sound awful, to be honest with you. I have personally never had it. But it usually occurs as a result of the breakdown of normal defenses in the stomach. So you have like mucus that surrounds your stomach, and this protects it from acid. So the barrier kind of like gets washed away or slowly deteriorates over time. So the tissues are going to be exposed to continuous damage because the acids are against the gastric wall. Because of this, you're going to have increase in inflammation, which we all know is not good for you, increased stress. So whenever the damaged area penetrates a blood vessel wall, it's going to start bleeding. And this bleeding can cause iron deficiency anemia or also blood in the stool, which is not cool at all. So a few risk factors of this are going to be H. pylori infection, which my roommate had at one point. Very unfortunate. I don't think it was in her stomach, but I think it was in her intestines. Hypoperfusion, excessive corticoid secretion or medication, aspirin or NSAIDs, alcohol intake, caffeine, or chronic gastritis, which is atrophy of the gastric mucosa, and atrophy means death. So treatment for this, you really just have to eradicate the underlying cause, otherwise it's just going to continue. Just taking care of the symptoms really is not going to do much. So if it's H. pylori, obviously get on something to cut that out, or withdraw from provoking agents. So your alcohol, your caffeine, spices, your spicy stuff. And then you could also take your H2 antagonists or your proton pump inhibitors to decrease the acidity and increase the pH in the stomach. So there's less acid against that wall. Also, we recommend that you increase your consumption of omega 3 and 6s because they can have a protective effect. And really, overall, just good nutrition is going to help defend against H. pylori. So if you have a good diet throughout your life, the chances of you getting H. pylori are kind of decreased. So just kind of keep that in mind. So next we have carcinoma of the stomach. Again, like we've been through the cancer section. I know this is like very much just more in depth into each cancer. So for gastric cancer, it's usually going to be asymptomatic in the early stages. A lot of times you're not going to diagnose it until later on, which is obviously not a good deal. So your risk factors are going to include in certain places it's going to have effect. So apparently in Japan, Iceland, Hungary, and Chile, it's going to increase your risk of having gastric cancer. I didn't know that personally. And apparently it's declining in America. So I guess that's good for me. Again, an H. pylori infection can increase your risk of gastric cancer. A diet including food preservatives and smoked foods can increase your risk. And then obviously you have genetics and chronic atrophic gastritis or polyps. So signs and symptoms of gastric cancer are going to look like, again, you're not going to have these until it's pretty advanced, but it's going to look like anorexia, early satiety, feelings of indigestion and epigastric discomfort, fatigue, weight loss. Incidental tests may reveal iron deficiency anemia or blood in stool as well. So whenever we get over to treatment, there's not much like we are able to do as dietitians. You could do a gastric resection. That's probably going to be the best. Obviously we aren't going to do that, but you kind of like, if that does happen, then we will step in and kind of work with those who have gastric bypass surgeries. And I could talk about this in this episode. I'll be honest, I'm really probably not going to, because I think bariatrics is really cool and I want to do a separate episode. So I may put that in between. Actually, I'm going to do, after the interview, I'll do one on bariatrics before we get into lower GI disorders, because bariatrics is solely on the stomach and upper intestines, and I think it would just be beneficial. So, yeah, we really can't do much in terms of treatment as dietitians. We want to be able to treat the symptoms as best we can, so helping people with food that they can tolerate. We want to be sure to really press on eat often and small meals, because they're going to be facing early satiety. Watch for if they're not reaching their calorie goals, we may need to do something such as enteral feeding. And then we also have the risk of dumping syndrome. So that's really fun to talk about. And it kind of goes along with gastric surgeries, but I'm not going to touch super hard on that. But let's just say, so if a patient does have a gastric surgery, they're going to be at risk for dumping syndrome. And this is going to mean that after a person hasn't been eating a whole lot, after a while, their body gets kind of used to it, and they have really low levels of electrolytes and everything. So if you're all of a sudden going to, like, shove a bunch of food into their body, and they're digesting that, and all of a sudden they have all these electrolytes everywhere, they have all this going on, the body is pretty much going to go into shock. It's going to be like, I can't handle this. I don't know what's happening. The electrolytes are going crazy. Heart arrhythmia because of the phosphorus or because of the potassium and weird muscle contractions. It's going to be kind of like that. So to kind of like offset that, the body is, it's hypotonic compared to like the food you're putting in it. And it just like, oh my gosh, there's food in me. So it is going to like try to expel that food pretty quickly. Oh my gosh, I'm so stupid. I was literally just talking about dumping syndrome like it was refeeding syndrome. Literally, I'm stupid. Okay, what I just described was refeeding syndrome. And that's what happens when someone hasn't been eating recently or at all. So disregard what I said about going into shock. That's refeeding syndrome. Dumping syndrome is not the same thing. I just read syndrome and I was like, oh, okay. So dumping syndrome is whenever you have large quantities of hypertonic food and liquids in the proximal small intestine. So whenever you have excessive amounts of liquid or solid food enter into the small intestine in a concentrated form, the body's gonna be like, oh my gosh. And especially with carbohydrates, body really doesn't like that. So yeah, give me a sec. I don't know why I'm having to collect my thoughts. Anyway, there's three different terms: early, intermediate, and late. So early dumping syndrome is going to be whenever you're going to like have abdominal fullness and nausea within 10 to 30 minutes of eating. So symptoms are going to be accelerated emptying of hyperosmolar gas contents into small intestines and a resulting fluid shifts from the circulation into the small intestine. So intermediate dumping syndrome occurs 20 to an hour after eating. And you're going to have abdominal bloating, increased flatulence, cramping, abdominal pain, explosive diarrhea, and symptoms of malabsorption. And then late dumping syndrome is going to occur 1 to 3 hours after eating. And you're going to have rapid delivery and utilization of carbs, which is going to produce increase in insulin levels followed by a huge decline in glucose levels. So this is when a patient is going to experience like flushing, sweating, they're going to be weak, rapid heartbeat, faint, and shaky. I feel like that just like wasn't a good description of what happens. But that's really the best I feel like I can do without talking about gastric surgeries first. So whenever I do touch on gastric surgeries, I'm going to go back over this because I feel like it doesn't make as much sense without it. So, but I'm going to just go ahead and say MNT for dumping syndrome. You want to address the malabsorption and weight loss because your body is dumping things out so fast. It's not absorbing anything. So you're going to be losing all those nutrients. You're going to want to increase your protein and fat intake because those are going to be better absorbed than your carbs, but you want to make sure that they aren't having like fatty stools or anything either. You want to limit your simple carbs. You want to increase your complex carbs, so your whole grains. And then you really want to be consuming liquids between meals and not during meals. And then also fiber supplements can be so good, especially pectins and gums, because they're going to delay that transit time and slow it down so you're able to absorb more. And then lastly, I'm just going to cover gastroparesis. This is just going to be delayed gastric emptying, so it's the opposite of dumping syndrome. Common causes are just going to be like a viral infection, diabetes, surgical procedures, and idiopathic. It can be idiopathic. And then your signs and symptoms are going to include abdominal bloating, anorexia, nausea, vomiting, fullness, early satiety, postprandial hypoglycemia, which postprandial just means after meal hypoglycemia, because your body isn't letting those carbs get through, or any of that food really get through, so your body's not absorbing it. MNT, you want to treat the symptoms, but really treatment is going to include pyrokinetics and antiemetics. So that was my little spiel about upper GI. I feel like it was, like I said, it was going to be all over the place. I already knew it was going to be. But I'm excited to talk about bariatric surgery next. So that should be exciting. This was a pretty short episode. Upper GI isn't as much as lower GI. So whenever we get into lower GI, I feel like we're going to have a lot more to talk about, because a lot of those are just a lot more in depth. And especially when we get to accessory organs as well, that will also be a lot more in depth. Upper GI is just pretty simple. So that is really all I have for this afternoon. And yeah, let me know if you have any questions. Feel free to reach out. I have my Instagram. That's all. Have a great day.